suddenly become an even better wife. She was calmer and more peaceful. She didn't preach at me or try to coerce me into going to church with her. She just loved me, took great care of Megan, and kept everything running smoothly in our home. Sometimes she'd mention offhand that she was praying for me, but that was it. It was hard to complain about. Then the man who had hired me at the insurance company died of leukemia. 2 years earlier, he'd remarried, and after his death, we'd learned that he'd put everything in his new wife's name. The company structure changed so drastically that as a result, it no longer worked for me. I knew I could fight for what had been promised to me, but that would mean a lot of legal expenses, which seemed crazy at the time. I also could have started my own office with the clients I had, but that would have created too much political fallout, and that didn't feel right either. I was conflicted. If I stayed, whatever I did would make a big stink in the community and ultimately reflect back on Christie's family. We decided it was time to move on. I learned that a large and established stock brokerage firm wanted to expand their business into the life insurance sector. I contacted them, and the general manager hired me to introduce the value of life insurance into wealthy clients' financial portfolios. Christie and I were extremely excited about this opportunity. We sold our house in Oklahoma and moved to the Seattle area. But when I arrived at the office for my new job, I discovered that the general manager who had hired me had been transferred to New York. The new GM wanted nothing to do with life insurance or with any new venture. In fact, he was determined that my project failed under his watch. And after the funding was pulled, failed it did. Big time. In hindsight, I can see this was the beginning of God allowing me to be broken in order to get my attention. I had to learn I could not do everything in my own strength. After this, I was offered a position with a sales training firm, which I enjoyed until the company got into financial trouble, so I had to look elsewhere. I ended up at a job where I did extremely well. I'd made millions in profits for that company and was financially very well rewarded. I thought I was back on track. Life at that company reflected stereotypical 1980s excess. For board meetings, they would have a 5-star restaurant bring in lox and bagels, fresh fruit, and a continental breakfast that would make royalty blush. During the first break in the morning, someone would start laying out lines of cocaine. No one flinched. This was just the way they lived, a privilege of wealth. They were snorting coke, eating gourmet food, making million-dollar deals. They assumed they could do whatever they wanted, and no one could call them on it. That was just the world they lived in, and it was my world, too. I had an expense account of $2,500 a month, which I used for taking clients to the nicest restaurants and private clubs in the state, and buying tickets for the Sonics, Mariners, and Seahawks. Christie and I owned a house on Green Lake in one of the more desirable neighborhoods in Seattle, and I drove a BMW. I was living in the fast lane and running with a fast company, but I still really had no idea who I was. Like many people in the first half of their lives, I was running hard to define who I was and to make my mark on the world. I was luckier than most because I had a good upbringing and a loving family at home, but I really didn't have anything to live for bigger than myself and my family. From a material success standpoint, I was doing well, but my soul was languishing. I was receiving accolades from those around me, but had yet to connect with my true purpose, discover my spiritual identity, or plug into my God-given calling. In fact, rather than doing the hard work of figuring out who I was taking the easy way out. And if I wasn't careful, I was going to die of stress or from drug or alcohol abuse. It's a horrible thing to die before you know who you are and what you're living for. There's an interesting aspect of identity described in the Hebrew commentaries that I believe is worth exploring here. According to Esther 2:5, in Shushan, the citadel there, was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Yair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. This text calls Mordecai a certain Jew, but it also says his lineage was that of a Benjamite. Though today we tend to confuse being Jewish with being Hebrew, the term Jew was originally applied to someone from the tribe of Judah, which was just one of the 12 tribes of Israel, as was the tribe of Benjamin. So which was it? Was Mordecai a Jew from the tribe of Judah, or a Benjamite from the tribe of Benjamin? If you look at the original language, it becomes clear, because the word referring to Mordecai in this passage is the word Yahudai. In the Torah, the Jewish term for the first 5 books of the Bible,